I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of a farmer in Arizona who got up one morning, fired up the tractor, and turned his field into a statement on urban sprawl. You wouldn't have seen Matthew Moore's artwork from the ground. You would have had to be flying into the Phoenix airport. Matthew mapped out a perfect replica of a new urban subdivision in this one field. He planted the streets and cul-de-sacs in black-bearded wheat that would shimmer in the desert sun like asphalt. Each one of the couple hundred houses was planted in sorghum so the maroon grass would mimic the Spanish tile roofs of the neighboring developments. He called it Moore Estates. And it wasn't so much a protest against the sprawl of Phoenix as it was a personal lament about what's happening to the land. The artist-farmer Matthew Moore will join me after the news to talk about a farmland planted with houses and what's really next for those amber waves. There's probably nowhere in the United States where the image of urban sprawl is as stark as Phoenix, Arizona. In the past 50 years, the city's grown from a few hundred thousand to something close to 4 million. It's one of the fastest growing cities in the country, and every year, more desert land, more farms give way to the shiny new strip malls and the pools and the homes and the schools and the acres of pavement and parking lot. When Matthew Moore was a schoolboy on the family farm, it was a half-hour drive into Phoenix. Now he can see the city from his own fence line. He knows that his own land will only grow a couple more crops before it too is planted in bricks and concrete. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Matthew Moore was raised on the farm outside Phoenix, but part of him always wanted to be an artist. 6 years ago, Matt was at a crossroads. He wasn't doing that well in art school. In fact, his professors were warning him that maybe he wouldn't last. So he came home, as he often did, to clear his head.
I came back to the farm, and I was just driving around and realized that the whole horizon had opened up, and I couldn't figure out why it looked so different. And what had happened was is they had taken about 320 acres of these citrus trees that had blocked our horizon view. So because it's so flat, we could never really see Phoenix. It was always covered by these citrus trees, and they had clear-cut all those and were grinding them up. And
they had been there for as long as you could remember?
Yeah, 70 years old or so.
Did they give you that feeling that you were, I don't know, not isolated or protected, but it gave you that sense that you were in the countryside and didn't really have to deal with the city of Phoenix?
It's interesting. It's how your visual landscape becomes so ingrained in you as a child, and that's part of our existence is that we were surrounded by these citrus trees, and I never thought too much twice about it, you know. And you know, what it did is there's not many trees indigenously in Phoenix, in this whole desert area.
Yeah.
And that promoted that whole idea of this respite in the desert.
Help me with just sort of distance and time. If you were to get in your car at your father's house at the farm and drive straight to Phoenix, how long would it take you to get to the city?
I actually went to school in downtown Phoenix, so it's 35 miles into like the center of downtown Phoenix, historical Phoenix.
But we're talking about the suburbs, and they're sort of sprawl outwards, right?
Right. So our closest at the time, a closest supermarket, was about 15 miles away or so. So there was this big barrier between the first residential areas. But when they took that grove out, then you could see there was this oncoming thing. And it was probably at that time in 2001 or 2, it was probably about 6 or 7 miles as a crow flies out.
For you to get to a shopping mall or to
cement, concrete,
parking lots, whatever it was, right?
Or to see neighbors, more importantly. So, I saw my neighbors 7 miles away at that point, and that was a pretty epic experience.
So when the trees came down, were you angry about that? Did you feel like, you know, for the first time, the farm won't be here indefinitely? What were your thoughts?
Yeah, that started the stages of loss, I would think. The idea of change onto something that I looked at to be this solid foundation for me to go back to and recharge, or mm-hmm. you know, to move out from. I was accessing all those histories from there to, you know, propel my life forward. And when I thought about it changing, I was so horrified that I couldn't help but be angry about it. And
Was there a part of you that, you know, wanted to call Willie Nelson and get Farm Aid and right. you know, put up a wall and say, you know, no more sprawl. Somehow we're going to protect my grandfather's farm. And at this point, you'd taken a break from art school. What were you thinking, that you just sort of howl at the moon and then go back to San Francisco?
You know, there was a part of me. This is the kicker, is that I'm the one who showed a little bit of interest in farming, but it's not my farm in a sense. You know, it's my, when the rubber meets the road, my grandfather is the landowner, and there's a greater family, about 30 people, a little more, that the farm supports in some manner. When you give a farmer the possibility of taking his land and selling it and doing good for his family, which is that American dream that started out with, you know, with the idea of owning your own land and providing for your family. The farming is still about that. So there's these chances that you have to do the best you can for your family, and development as of now is one of the, you know, the greatest goods that you can do for your family in agriculture, as sad as it can be, you know.
So take me back to that summer. Okay. What did you do?
I ran back to San Francisco, and I started to read Wendell Berry and a lot of other agriculturalists or poets, and just started to think a little bit more, what was it about the land that was important to me? Before I got all upset about it, I really had to suss out what it was so important to me. And I'm still sussing that out to this day and trying to understand, what is it when I think about my kids don't have that connection to the land that I have now, what is it about it that tears me up? And I haven't answered that question, but when I talk about that idea, it's hard for me to even figure out why it's so important. And that's what started that summer. And I went back, and the only way I could reconcile this collision of urban and rural that I saw with that citrus down and the oncoming waves of people moving in was to create artwork.
So when Matt went back to art school that fall, he actually took some of the wheat he'd harvested from the farm. He took it to San Francisco State with the plan to hang it in a gallery as an art project that was finally something much closer to what really mattered to him. However, at the end of the year, he still faced that decision about what he was going to do with his MFA and what he was going to do about the farm.
When I got out of graduate school, there was this choice. There was this choice to stay in the Bay Area and try and make it in this art world that, you know, at that time was really, it's a really difficult, being an artist is a really difficult thing. And to sustain yourself and to make a living is really hard in art, not to mention in farming.
But you chose the two easy ones, right? Art and farming.
Right.
But help me with something here. Now, you took these sheaves of grain off to San Francisco. You hung them from the roof to try and figure out if there was any place for that sort of, you know, amber wave scene in the center of a city. But at some point, you concluded that the best way to use art to address this clash of urban and rural was to do some large, I was going to call it a performance piece, but installation art using your own farm. Where did that idea come from?
When I left school, I knew I had to go back to the farm to accept my destiny, but that I knew I was always going to be back there, but I knew that I had a finite amount of time and really to archive and figure out, to have as much information I could as possible about that farm before it went away. And at that time, it wasn't, it was probably had about 10 years to go is what we figured. And so when I came back, my dad stepped back and I took over the farm, and I grow 320 acres of carrots and 100 acres of parsnip and 400 acres of grain. And so my scale is relatively large and I'm comfortable working with that. So when I see, you know, I have a medium, right? Now I have all my fields are broken up into 20 and 30 acre fields or 40 acre fields. And so that just was, it's hard for me to explain why I'm comfortable with that scale and why I picked it, but it was just seemed obvious that I had to work on the land. And I was so used to looking at these aerial photographs for research that I saw the farm from about 500 feet above ground whenever I drove around it. I was always looking down at it. And then it was at that moment that I thought, oh, okay, well, since you're looking at it like that, why not use one of those little cubes and do a project? And it at this time, so this is 2003, and now the houses are probably about 3 miles away as a crow flies. So in 2 years, I mean, it just, boom, it just came out. And then I was going to these suburbs. I'd be driving down the road looking at one of our fields, and I'd get distracted, and I'd start driving through these suburban communities, all these little paved roads that were out in this, you know, carrot field that was there about 6 months ago. And I'd go to the main office, and then I'd get all their floor plans for the homes that they were going to sell there. I probably had about 50 different floor plans from different developers in the area. And I started to look at those lines and what they meant, and just the lines of a floor plan on the wall. And then that's when I first came up with the first earthwork I did, or land art piece, which was basically a 950 foot by 450 foot floor plan that I carved out of this barley field.
So try to picture that, the floor plan of a single house that's 950 feet by 450 feet. Matthew's canvas in this case was a 20-acre field, and the lines were carefully cut in barley. Now, you could only see it from the air, and you don't, in fact, have to imagine it. You can see pictures on our website of Matthew Moore's piece. It was called Rotations, Single Family Residence. That's at thestory.org. Now, in just a moment, Matt will explain how that rather unconventional planting led to an even larger project, a subdivision made of grass and grain. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. A few years back, Matthew Moore was watching the encroachment of new Phoenix subdivisions, with the digging and the dust and the new housing moving ever closer to his own farm. But Matthew's also an artist, and his own response was to cut the floor plan of one such new home in barley, in a field on the family's farm.
I wheeled off the whole entire field and had a measurement, and then I drew a floor plan in the middle of it to the best scale so it looked good, you know. It's just basically like looking at a canvas. But my canvas happens to be 20 acres, so the hardest part is getting straight lines. And so I had to do all the Pythagorean theorem at, you know, 400 foot to make sure I was square. And I just started hoeing. And that's the most ridiculous part of the whole thing is that I hoed. And I didn't want you to see the trails of a tractor going in there. And plus, it's so hard to drive a tractor that straight. I'm a farmer, but man, I just can't drive those tractors straight. So it was the only way for me to do it and be ensure that it was, there's a obsessive compulsive nature to myself that, I mean, it had to be perfect. And the lines of the floor plan are 8 feet wide. And I would just put two stakes in the ground with string across it, and I'd start going for it. And it was a meditative endeavor, you know. So I was planning on that, and that's why I chose a hoe, is because I really needed to go out there and think about what I was doing. And during that 4 months, I basically realized that, you know, here I am, I grow this field of barley, and I go out there, and as a farmer, I go and I cut down the space for a house. And that's the reality of, you can't, that's when I realized that as a farmer, that anger started to go away, because I'm a farmer now, I'm a part of this program, and I'm letting that development come in. And that opened up a whole new reality for me.
Your father's a pilot, right? He flies, he's got his own plane?
Yeah.
So you could go up and look down at the big old house plan that you'd carved in the barley field, right?
Yeah, that was my only way to make sure I was straight. That, I tell you, that first flight, I had three lines up, and we took off, and you know, it's about 3 miles away from, the runway was on a farm, and we took off, and we pulled up there, and I thought, oh, please don't make it look like a trapezoid, you know?
How did it look?
And it looked great. I couldn't believe it, actually. Everybody was pretty amazed that I nailed it, But
this is the part that interests me. Who else saw it? I mean, were you getting feedback from commercial pilots who were coming into Phoenix? Who was looking at your piece of art?
It's funny that you say that, because Luke Air Force Base is about 10 miles away from us. So Luke Air Force Base is 10 miles away, and their flight pattern goes right over that field. So there would be these pilots, as I would be out there hoeing that image, that would, you know, just tilt the plane all the way at a 90-degree angle to see what the hell I was doing. So I knew that there, and I had to, I always waved. I never could see them, you know, they're going so fast. But I think that between my dad and those pilots were probably the only people, which is good, because that was a big piece. I mean, as much as I say that I'm comfortable at that scale, I really didn't know if it was going to work. And when I finished that project, when my father and I are flying, I started to get these photographs, and they would be, I didn't ever do a straight overhead aerial shot, straight down on it, because that, it wasn't the point of the image, it was the context. And so when you back off that camera and then you shoot to the horizon of Phoenix, you get the sense of what we're dealing with and what kind of place this is and why it is so one of the fastest growing areas in the nation. And also when we did that, all of these little agricultural 30 and 40 acre chunks are split up like lots. And my floor plan in that first lot, when I looked ahead, I thought, oh, that's why they're coming out here, is because we laid the foundation for them to come. Every one of our little lots, one of our 20 acre plans, is a perfect, it's just a house. It's all it is a lot.
You mean those farmers' fields that we grew up with, the concession roads just neatly divided it up for this development, you know, Cotton Acres and then Aspen Acres and all these developments that come marching towards your grandfather's farm.
Right, and I think it was in that flight that I really realized that, okay, that's when the question, it went from how dare you come here to... How did we come here, and why are we here, and why are we at this point?
And why did I not see that this was coming, right?
Right,
exactly. There becomes something inevitable about it at that point.
There is, and I think that was the biggest realization, and was the next step towards getting through these stages of loss.
Matt, can you look back and pinpoint a moment when you stopped being angry, when you had that realization that the transformation of the farmland into subdivisions was not only inevitable, but maybe something that was going to happen and should happen as the land gets eaten up and used?
When I was probably not when I was flying, because I was probably, you know, white knuckling it or something, you know. I think that it's always, there's always a tinge that it creeps back in where you get this little chill up your spine, and there's this moment of flash of like, I don't want this to happen. And there's a little bit of anger in there, you know, it's just tingles in every now and then. But I mean, I'm always fighting that sort of knee-jerk reaction. And then that's the reaction that we're raised with, that this agriculture is this really pastoral dream and it's coveted. And, you know, when I would say, yes, my family's land is going to be overtaken by sprawl, or my family's land is going to be taken over by suburban development, then people would go, oh, I'm so sorry for you. But they're sorry for themselves. They're sorry for that idea being transformed into something. They lose that pastoral dream by hearing about farmers and their vision of farmers in front of a big red barn and, you know.
But I'm a part of that too, and I'm listening to you and I'm thinking to myself, am I wrong to so romanticize the farm? Am I wrong to have that kind of, you know, deeply emotional attachment to that sense that that's where, you know, milk comes from and vegetables come from, and the comfort of knowing that, you know, even if I buy stuff that's, you know, triple washed and in a plastic bag, somewhere out there is a man or a woman in a pair of overalls who's making sure that I get that. I mean, I realize as I'm saying it just how old-fashioned it is, but I think that we all carry some of that, you know, with us from the time that someone first sung Old McDonald's to us, you know?
Yeah, I think you're right, but you got to understand from my perspective as a farmer that I would be lying to you if I capitalized on your vision of a romantic farmer. I would argue that the majority of our agriculture is not that pastoral dream because it's a big business now in a lot of ways. And so that's what just for myself, I had to realize that when I did that floor plan, I made it so I passed as little judgment as possible on that reality. All I did was present a reality.
Matthew Moore's seasonal artwork was called Rotations, Single Family Residence, but it was nothing compared to what came next. Matt's piece, Rotations, Moore Estates, was the recreation of an entire subdivision over 40 acres. The idea for that came when Matt's family gave up the first slice of their farm to developers.
My grandfather sold the first 80 acres to a developer, and they were going to start building. And it was at that point that's when the encroachment came onto our land. It was a reality that it's actually on the ground that has historically been owned by the family since the 40s. And so that was a big moment. I remember my whole family was out in this carrot field where this development is now. And it was the last time that we harvested carrots in that field. And that was a really epic moment to realize that was never going to be in production anymore.
What happened in that field? Who said what to who? What can you tell me about that moment?
I can't even express what it's like to see that for myself.
Was your father there? Was your grandfather there?
Yeah, you know, there's a different relationship that I see that I have. I mean, I'm pretty green, you know, in terms of being a farmer. I'm 3 years in the hole now, you know, and my father and my grandfather, my father farmed for 22, 26 years, somewhere in there, and then my grandfather for, you know, 40 some odd years, more than that. And there's been a lot of hard times, really, really hard times, where you put your house up to be able to get seed to plant the next year to hope that you can make up, you know, the two bad years that you had before that. And so there's a different relationship that they had with this land than I had. And so when I was at that moment, you know, my mother was there. My mother has a really, I think we all have a kind of remorse that we're not going to be able to bring to share and those experiences that we had in childhood on the farm. And
did your mother say something at that time then?
My mother was crying, and and my mother was crying, and God, it was a bad field of carrots, too.
You know, the dirt from that field is still somewhere in the cracks of the fingers of your grandfather. I mean, that's the attachment to that land will never, you know, disappear. And I'm not asking or, you know, wrenching the family photo album out of your hands and saying, here, let me look at that. But I think that somewhere in our understanding of how you said farewell to that field is something that's going to bring us a little bit closer to an understanding of how you feel about the land.
There's a smell that's really important to for me as a farmer, and that smell of ground being turned over is like a it's like a new chance, and the smell of fresh dirt in the air. That's moist is potential. And when you're harvesting, your endeavors for the past year, all your wants, hopes, and dreams are coming out of the ground. And there's a smell to that moment. There's also a sight to that moment, and there's a sense of accomplishment. But that clean slate, that chance that you have for the next year, when that's taken away, it's really, really a difficult experience.
Are you giving up that attachment to that piece of land, or is it more than that? Are you also acknowledging that you're giving up your attachment to the profession, to farming, and this is just one small piece of that encroachment?
I think you nailed it on the head there. I think it's that was the first. You know what's so important about that moment? It was the reality. Okay, that. Those numbers that, you know, when at first you're just looking at numbers, okay, and probably in 10 years there'll be something here. Or and all those numbers became a reality.
Right. That,
okay, I am the last farmer of four generations. I'm a fourth generation farmer, and I will be the last to farm that ground, period. And that statement is so... It carries with it so much feeling, and you know, there's some good parts of it, and there's some really hard parts about that. And when you're sitting there, and then the reality of that sentence happens, because mm-hmm. this is the last time we're going to farm that, and then they're going to come in and they're going to scrape all this flat and put houses there, and we're going to have neighbors, and you know, we're going to be. This begins the end of one way of life. And at that moment, and you can say that sentence in a lot of ways that, you know, has anger, has loss, and also there's ways to say it that have hope.
I'm talking with the artist and farmer, Matthew Moore. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Matt says he already knows what will happen to the farm. He's been told that the land will soon become the nation's largest auto mall. Matt thinks about this in personal terms, what that transformation means for him and for his ancestors, but he's also thinking of it in bigger terms, like the implications of the change for the climate and the fact that Phoenix is already struggling with population density and water shortages.
The most difficult thing about this is that my family is going to do well from this land sale. And, you know, you spend a lot of time wondering about what that means. And how it makes you feel, and there's a lot of angry, oh God, this is hard to talk about.
It's like right at the center of it. This is coming to terms with profiting from the transformation of the land into something that you would, or other people, or all of us would sooner not see there, just for, you know, preservation of the planet purposes, right?
Right, and I think that this is the problem with. That I see with Phoenix. If you think there's a problem with suburban development, you can't just curb it. You got to look back at the bigger picture here, and it starts a long time ago. And part of the problems with global climate change and stuff like that, you could probably draw some lines to conventional agriculture. And I certainly do in the desert. And it's what I know. And I see that when we put in the canal systems to bring water from the Colorado to the middle of the desert here, and we leveled the desert, and we grew this lush green crops in the middle of the desert. And it seemed at that time that this is a very sustainable place to live. You know, look at all the growth. I mean, how could it not be? And there's a lot of problems with that vision, and they come to that rampant growth. And what, we're still a desert, you know, and I would argue that you have such a lack of sense of that when you're here. And when you're driving around these communities, you could be anywhere. And it's that loss of sense of space that becomes really, really important.
Many years have passed since those summer days among the fields of barley. See the children run as the sun goes down. As you lie in fields of gold, you remember me when the west wind moves among the fields of barley. You can tell the sun in his jealous sky when we walked in fields of gold. When we walked in fields of gold, when we walked in fields of gold.
So where does Matthew Moore go from here? In just a moment, we'll talk about the fact that he's still learning how to farm and figuring out if that's something that's compatible with his other love, his love of art. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Matthew Moore is a farmer near Phoenix. He's also an artist who has used the family fields as a place to plant a green version of houses, shops, and subdivisions that will someday soon occupy the land he has inherited. Matt says it's one way he tries to come to terms with the consequences of selling farmland to developers, of profiting from that transformation of the land.
I think that I've gotten over the guilt of, you know, that's guilt is a very powerful word. And that's something that what I feel guilt to is the forsaking that pastoral vision of a farmer, that as we sell part of that land, you know, I'm taking away from that a little bit. Right. And so, look, it's, you know, I think that it's what you do that when I look to the future of myself and my endeavors, I have a drive to try and help instigate change. And through these artworks, I have been able to get this public forum and a discussion to start talking about this in a different way than graphs or, you know, just numbers on paper. And I feel like this money is actually going to help make it so I can do more of those projects.
When the farm is gone and sold and your dad's house and your grandfather's house are no longer there and the carrot field is already gone, I mean, you'll have pictures and you know, pieces of history, family history that you'll all get to keep with you. But what will matter most to you? What picture will you carry in your mind from that place where you grew up?
I'm still trying to create that picture. And I took it for granted for a long time. I think about those moments that I was out there in that relationship that I have with it as a steward. Being out there and being concerned for the crops and worrying about them and putting water to them and, you know, getting the weeds out of all that experience of that relationship between the ground. That's what I'm going to carry with me. That's what seems to be present now.
I mean, we talked earlier about trying to determine if it is a relationship with a physical piece of land or if it is a relationship with the profession of being a farmer, and perhaps some of your reluctance to form that picture right now and sort of set it in your mind is that you're still becoming a farmer. You're still making that part of that personal picture.
I think so. And, you know, because of the artwork and the farming, I mean, it's they exist together. They have to. For the short amount of time that I have, I have to do both as best I can, as much as I can. And to be able to create exactly what you're talking about, actually. So thank you for revealing that to me, that I'm still trying to become a farmer and feel like I have a good vision of myself in that role. Not just the idea of what that means, but actually doing it and being a part of that and getting that relation with that ground.
I didn't reveal that to you. You told me that you watched your father and your grandfather, standing there in that carrot field and came to that own realization that they have some kind of connection that you yet don't have with either the profession or the land.
I think that, as a farmer, what you're doing is you really are trying to keep producing, and you're producing for who? You're producing for your family, and to keep this farm, it's part of your family. So there's this vision of the future, right? And the hope of the future, and the hope of a brighter future. And next year is going to be the bumper crop year. There's always that hope when you throw that seed in the ground. And when I finished that project of the Moore Estates and all those houses, and we were flying it, and they were developing that development off in the back, and I thought, here comes 250 homes, 250 families who are starting their own histories on ground that my family has held for our own for the last 70 years. And that's where all that hope comes in. And there's a lot of, they're going to have their own stories and their own connections that I could never have foreseen, mm-hmm. or never be a part of, but we're part of that, mm-hmm. and we're connected now. And so that can be as part of the same process. Are we nurturing the future by bringing families there? That was a big leap for me, and I think it still is a leap sometimes, but I mean, it's really an important reality. And all these things are ways to make me not hate the idea that the farm's gone. I mean, everything I do, I mean, I just don't want to leave with this bitter, I don't want that to taint the vision that you're talking about, that what are you going to bring with you? I don't want it to be those people force me out of there, or development force, evolution of natural evolution force me out of this, and I hate it for it. I don't want to leave that way, because we have a lot of role in it. But it's hard sometimes when you look to the future of developing in a desert and in the face of global climate change and, God, the situations that we face, and how are we going to deal with them, and how are we going to experience them? Because it's hard to look that far in the future for me to see what it's going to look like. So the only way I can do it is through these projects. And hopefully it does the same to other people as well. Well, and it seems to have.
There's no question that your artwork gives us lots to think about, and you have today in this conversation as well. So I thank you for your time.
No, thank you.
Matthew Moore says once his family's land is sold, he hopes to take the proceeds from that and move somewhere else. He's thinking of the Pacific Northwest to try farming in a part of the country that's perhaps better suited to planting and harvesting and not jousting with the bulldozers. We have a number of links on our website. You can see pictures there of Matthew's installation artwork. It's all at thestory.org. You know that I am always pestering you for your own stories, but the truth is we need your help to make the story, this program, succeed. David Carter contacted us with a story about his friend Alan Carroll Saval in Waterville, Maine. Now, David doesn't specifically recall the last time he saw or spoke with Alan before Alan's unexpected death, but he does remember the lessons Alan taught him.
He had a group that he went fishing with on a regular basis. One year I asked him if I could go, and there wasn't room for me that year. So I felt the appropriate response was to say, well, the least you can do is bring us back some fish. And he returned from the trip. I guess it was the day after he returned, and we had a mailbox that attached to the house. That day I got a handful of dead fish and relayed this story to the loony lawyer next door, who thought, well, we have to do something with this. And he drafted a lawsuit claiming harassment by fish and so on and so forth. And so everyone enjoyed that little slice of life and the way it played out with
him. It sounds to me in a way like that was, your friend Alan aside, kind of a special time in your life, one of those moments that we get as adults when we find ourselves in with a group of people. Is that a reasonable way of looking back on that?
Absolutely. When we moved to Maine, I had never been any further north than Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. We got to Maine scared and ended up loving it. We loved Maine. And the neighborhood where I met Alan represented the neighborhood where we purchased our first house. So there were all of those feelings that go with I'm committing to a house and all the things that go with that. Well, then we end up meeting these people on the street that were wonderful. They were absolutely wonderful.
And they
friends.
Must have loved your Virginia accent as well.
We had the ongoing banter with one another. I love your accent. Well, I don't have an accent. You have the accent. So it was fun. But we were, I think we were extremely lucky to land where we did on that particular street at the time we did with the neighbors we had. And I think it was maybe one of those rare times when everything came together and everyone ended up on the street. And it was just a wonderful collection of people that were great friends.
In fact, it was Alan who came up with the suggestion of a name for your firstborn son, right?
We talked during my wife's first pregnancy about appropriate names if it was a boy. And Alan was very insistent upon making sure the young man knew his heritage was from the South. And so the name Diesel Freight Train came up in conversation. And he just thought that was excellent, that there would be no question from anyone that this was a young man who had Southern
roots.
And
was probably heartbroken when you didn't choose that name.
He always said Diesel Freight Train was a good name.
Tell me what happened to Alan.
We were awakened the morning of the 26th of August, 1985, by our next-door neighbor, the loony lawyer, who came and wanted to tell us about a plane wreck. He didn't want us to hear it on the news or hear it on the radio because we had just come back to Maine for the final move. They were actually packing.
You were on your way out of Waterville at that time, right?
We were on the way out of Waterville moving to Wilmington, Delaware.
Right.
And our next-door neighbor wanted to tell us what had happened overnight, again, so we wouldn't see it on the news.
He knew Alan had died in that plane crash?
He apparently learned during the morning hours, yes.
Right.
And so he came next door, knocked on the door. My wife answered the door. And he relayed the news that Alan had been killed in a plane wreck along with seven other people. Initially, I thought it was bad weather. I thought maybe my next-door neighbor had said bad weather or whatever. I think over time, it was at night, but I think it just ended up being a bad landing for whatever reason. And all eight folks on that plane were killed.
What do you remember about the way that news sort of landed in that circle of friends in Waterville?
Our specific street was devastated. Certainly I was. My wife was. Others were in disbelief, that rejection. You can't believe that it's true. Melissa and I were especially heartbroken in so many ways. We couldn't go to the funeral. We were in the midst of a move. We were encouraged by Alan's wife not to put the brakes on the move. Not that they didn't know what they were going to do in terms of burying Alan, but they had to get all those plans together. And at the time, his wife was unable to tell us the funeral will be on Thursday, it'll be on Friday or Wednesday. So I wonder about that decision now, 22 years later. I think we did the right thing. I hope we did the right thing. But not going to his funeral was difficult. Would I do it over again? Would I change it? I don't know. I don't know.
I sat back and thought to myself, I wonder if David looks back on that, and so I ask you this as a question. I wonder if you look back on that as a kind of a time in your life where both the death and the move bring to a really kind of sudden end a nice couple of years that you get to reflect back on when you were young, when things were a little simpler, you know?
Sure, sure. We look back at our time in Maine with great fondness. We loved Maine, a lot of firsts for us, first house, first child, that neighborhood where we had really remarkable friends. And so it's wonderful now at this stage of life to sit back and reflect upon that two-year period and know what we had and what we did and how unique I think that really was and how wonderful it really was.
You named your second son after Alan, right?
Yes. As I remember, we named him as we were leaving the hospital. It had been that difficult of a decision. We felt very compelled to honor Alan and name our second son after him. I'm sorry.
I'm thinking to myself, you knew this man, Alan, for 2 years. It's not a long time to form a friendship.
Mm-mm.
But something happened in that period of 2 years. Have you been able to think back to what it was?
He was as good, I think, with me as a young guy who wasn't particularly comfortable in his skin about a lot of things, as he was with my dad. My mom and dad visited one time, and Alan and my dad sat and listened to country music together because they both loved it. He could relate, I think, to so many different people in so many different ways, and I just admired him.
Sounds like he was sort of an older brother. I don't know if you had an older brother, but was he like that to you?
He was very much like an older brother. And I don't have an older brother, so I'm sure that was a bit of a role that he fulfilled just in grand style to me. He held our son when he was a newborn and quieted him, comforted him. He had two daughters, and so he had done the baby thing and was more comfortable than we were at that time. He was a nice guy. He was just genuinely a nice guy.
David Carter lives in Greensboro, North Carolina. If you have an idea of a story that you'd like to propose to me, send me a note. Go to our website. We're at thestory.org. You're listening to The Story from American Public Media. I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up tomorrow, we continue the story of coming to terms with child obesity. Yesterday, you may recall, I talked with Deborah and Sean Good. Deborah's a grandmother. Sean's a 9-year-old, and they are facing together the challenge of changing diet and starting exercise. Deborah says the dangers of Sean's extra weight were only made clear much later, not when he was younger.
I would always ask his pediatricians, isn't he too big? And they always told me that if they cannot pick up any layers of fat, that he was just a big child. There's a difference between a big child and a fat child.
Now, what do you mean by pick up a layer of fat?
Like if you can't...
Just grab a
right,
roll.
Grab an inch, a half an inch, or a fourth of an inch. They never could do that with him. A different doctor saw him one day, and she was saying, wow, he's gained like 15 pounds in 6 months. And I was saying, that is too much. Don't you think that's too much? And she was saying, yes, and I'm going to do something about it.
15 mm-hmm. pounds in 6 months, that's a lot of weight to put
it
on.
It is a lot. It shocked me.
That's Deborah Good talking about her grandson, Sean Good. Tomorrow on The Story, we'll continue our look at child obesity, and we'll hear from one mother, her name's Daphne Loke, and the day she got an unsettling phone call about her own daughter's unexpected weight gain.
They called in January and said, this is Kim from Dr. Armstrong. We would da-da-da-da. And I said, who are you? She said, well, this is Kim Yancey. And I said, why are you calling me? And she said, well, we're at Duke, and we're at the High Five for Fitness program, and da-da-da. And I said, and who is she? And she said, well, Dr. Armstrong specializes in pediatric obesity. I said, why are you calling me? Why are you calling me? I didn't ask for a physician that specialized in pediatric obesity. I asked for her to get some blood tests done. I was shocked. And I said,
what was it that put you off? The word obesity?
Well, when you talk about pediatric obesity, absolutely, because not my daughter. My daughter just has weight problems. My daughter isn't obese. I was looking my parenting in the face in that one phone call. I was just beside myself. I was in total denial.
And taking it out on the
person. And taking it out on poor Kim Yancey.
Daphne Logue is my guest tomorrow as we continue the story of child obesity. If you have suggestions or ideas of stories that you'd like to propose to me, again, go to our website. We're at thestory.org. Or you can leave me a message on our toll-free line at 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.